Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang gunutarang upacayang namasami. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha says that craving is the cause of suffering. It's important to remember, of course, that craving is not synonymous with desire. In Buddhist tradition, we consider there to be two kinds of desire, wholesome desire and unwholesome desire. In Pali language, unwholesome desire is called craving, tanha, and wholesome desire is called chanda. So the Buddha encourages us to reflect on the ways in which tanha conditions suffering and encourages us to develop chanda or wholesome desire. So a common misunderstanding of Buddhism is that practice in order to get rid of all desire and end up like sort of dry sticks or rocks and lifeless, heartless human beings with no passion and no life to us at all. Whereas what the Buddha actually taught was that we should learn how to channel the desire from the craving channel, the craving, the stream of craving, the river of craving, as the Buddha called it, into the path of chanda. Now, the difference is that craving arises from ignorance, and chanda arises from knowledge. So whenever you don't understand something, you don't clearly understand its nature, you inevitably experience craving with desire, with regard to that object. Whenever you clearly understand something, then the desire that arises is chanda. Craving is always craving for the result. Chanda is the desire for the action. Craving sullies, agitates, disturbs the mind. Chanda brightens, energizes the mind. So in our practice we seek to find ways in which to encourage chanta, bring forth chanta. ways in which we can enjoy our spiritual life, our spiritual practice. One of the qualities of the noble ones, the characteristics of the noble lineage, is that a noble one enjoys the abandonment of the unwholesome and enjoys the development of the wholesome. Buddhism is not a belief system. I like to characterize it as an education system. But faith does have a role to play. Fundamental faith of Theravada Buddhist, at least, is in the enlightenment of the Buddha. None of us, I think, can prove exactly what took place 2,500 years ago under the Bodhi tree. We have faith that the Buddha was enlightened. And we have faith that the Buddha was enlightened as a human being and was enlightened, therefore, as a representative of the human race and demonstrated clearly through his enlightenment the potential for enlightenment within the human being. And so this faith is called leads onwards. It's not just a belief to adopt and a belief that leaves you where you started. It's a belief that leaves you onward. If you believe in the potential of the human being for enlightenment, you are led on to the conclusion that you too have the capacity for enlightenment. So in other words, the belief, the faith in the Buddha's enlightenment is faith in your own capacity for enlightenment. If you have firm faith in your capacity for enlightenment, then you are led on to the effort to produce the causes and conditions for that realization of enlightenment. Practically speaking, it means we have a strong faith in our capacity to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify our minds. And this is the way that life becomes meaningful, worthwhile. This is the way that we fully realize our humanity. So the faith in our capacity for enlightenment bound up with a particular way of looking at ourselves entails a recognition that there is nothing fixed, stable within the body and mind. We look closely at our bodies, our feelings, our perceptions, our thoughts, sense consciousness, and we see a flow, a conditioned flow of phenomena. So we're not adopting a philosophical position here. We're just training our attention and looking closely at the nature of things. Sometimes discussions about Buddhist cosmology lead to a lot of disagreements or arguments, and people are curious, but Buddhist teaching on past lives, future lives, but these teachings will never be anything more than ideas and concepts without clear penetration of this present moment. If you can clearly perceive the nature of the five khandhas in the present moment, then the teachings on rebirth will become very clear. We have this capacity to look and to learn from experience. In Buddhism, we make a clear distinction between knowing and believing. In many belief systems, a kind of circular reasoning is perceived, in which one says, I believe in this because it's true. It's true because I believe in it. How do you know it's true? Well, I wouldn't have such a strong sense of faith and certainty if it was not true. In Buddhism, we have the beautiful teaching of Satchanuraka, which means caring for the truth. We care for the truth by being very scrupulous about distinguishing between that which we know as a direct experience and that which we take upon ourselves out of faith. So, as regards the teachings on rebirth, we may say, I believe in the teachings of rebirth because of all the teachings of the Buddha in the Tipitaka, because of the memory of past lives affirmed, asserted by great meditators, by the memory of past lives amongst children, people under hypnosis. And we conclude, with all this evidence, I have a firm belief or faith in rebirth, but I don't actually know whether it's true. This attitude, I think, is the attitude that can lead to true peace in the world. Very humble kind of peace, where a Muslim can say, I believe there's only one God, his name is Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. I believe this very strongly, but I don't actually know it's true. And a Christian can say, I believe in God. I believe that Jesus was his son and died for our sins. Believe it very strongly, but I don't know. And a Buddhist can say all the things that a Buddhist believes in and adds that he doesn't know or she doesn't know. So all the world religions can get together on this very humble level, instead of all saying we're all teaching the same thing, using different words, we're all go to the same ultimate state, even though nobody's actually even penetrated their own religion to that level, let alone any other religion. But if we come down a level or two and say, no, nobody knows. The Muslim doesn't know, the Christian doesn't know, the Buddhist doesn't know. And we know what we know and we know what we don't know. And this is the Buddhist path to world peace. Recognizing the distinction between faith and knowledge. But at the same time, as Buddhists, we say we do have the capacity to know. We have it within us, we can nurture it, but it requires a comprehensive training and education of every aspect of our lives. The Theravada Buddhist position is very, very clear on this, that the development of meditation will only be truly successful with a very firm foundation of morality. It's true that people who lead rather heedless, unwise lives can develop samadhi, can experience quite blissful states of mind. But firstly, those states of mind are not sustainable in the long run. And secondly, they do not reach the level of samasamadhi. So samasamadhi that the Buddha taught as the final element of the Noble Path is that kind of samadhi which is based on morality and most importantly provides the foundation for wisdom. So the Buddhist Theravada position is not that someone who doesn't keep precepts can't make their mind calm on occasion, can't experience blissful states of mind, but it will never be the calm, clarity, stability of mind which will lead to liberating insight. The tendency in the modern world is often to consider everything a matter of technique, and often feel that the problem with their meditation practice is that they haven't quite got the technique down, that there's some special esoteric technique which once mastered will do the trick. The Buddha made clear that without the absence of remorse, the sense of well-being, the sense of self-respect that comes through keeping precepts, then no real breakthrough, no real understanding of the human condition will result. Morality in our tradition is not a matter of commandments. There's no reward and punishment from a superior being. Living within precepts means using mindfulness of precepts as a tool to drive a wedge between volition and action and illuminate the impermanent and selfless nature of volition. So we undertake the training rule to refrain from taking life. We undertake the training rule to refrain from lying, from stealing, and so on. One, because these are the most intelligent ways of living in community and create a sense of trust and harmony, which create that sense of security important for us to experience in order to be brave enough to let go of internal protection offered by attachments. But importantly, it provides the sense of well-being that enables the mind to become calm. Mindfulness is not a kind of floating, nebulous quality. We always have to be mindful of something. Mindfulness needs a peg. Mindfulness needs an object. We can't just be mindful. So in our lives, whether we're monastics or householders, in each situation we find ourselves in, we ask ourselves, how can we be mindful in this situation? Of what should we be mindful in this situation? In formal meditation practice, at the beginning of the sitting, beginning of the walking period, we ask ourselves, we remind ourselves of our object. What is our goal? What is our intention for this meditation session? You don't want to be having to make decisions within a meditation session. You need to be quite clear about what you're doing right from the very beginning. If you give your mind clear instructions at the beginning of a meditation session, those instructions will just pop up into the mind automatically at the right time during the meditation session. In the practice of Anapanasati, there may come a point at which the sensation of the breath disappears. And for many people, for most people, that's quite a frightening experience. And at the time that it occurs, you don't have the opportunity to really reason with yourself or to decide what to do. The skillful means of dealing with this is that beginning of a meditation session, you would remind yourself that 2,500 more years have passed since the Buddha was teaching, and in all of that time there does not appear to be anybody who has ever keeled over and died while practicing Anapanasati, that the lack of awareness of the breath, disappearance of the breath as the mind becomes very subtle, is not dangerous. If it was dangerous, all the great compassionate teachers of the past 2,000 years would have warned their students against this practice, but none of them do. Being in a state where the mind is very bright and still, little, no experience of the breath is in no way dangerous at all. So if one reminds oneself of this at the beginning of a meditation practice, if the meditation should reach that stage, the remembrance of that reflection pops up in the mind and prevents the mind from withdrawing from a state of calm out of fear. So being very clear in a meditation what exactly you want to do. If there's been a particular problem that arises on a frequent basis, then reminding oneself of the particular antidote for that problem right at the beginning of the meditation. Similarly, in daily life, one reminds oneself, what should I be mindful of in this situation? Certain cases we'll be mindful of the body, mindful of feelings, mindful of mental states. There's always something that we can be mindful of. Getting up in the morning, how does that feel? How does it change? Do you always feel the same way every morning? Where does your mind go when you're having a shower, when you're brushing your teeth, when you're getting dressed? Are you present? Are you with the physical reality that is manifesting at that time? Or is your mind wandering off into the future and what you're going to do after that task is performed? Our life begins to experience real integrity and groundedness when we give equal respect to every duty, every responsibility that we have. A sense of respect for brushing your teeth, respect for having a shower, respect for washing the dishes, respect for walking from one building to another building. If you give respect to all those very minor and mundane activities in your life, then begin to feel more and more at home in the present moment. The more at home you are in the present moment, the more the trivial junk thinking diminishes, the more reflective thinking can appear in the mind. Remember, the mindfulness is not just a matter of being present, but it's mindfulness within the context of the Four Noble Truths. Being mindful of three characteristics. So if you're showering, for instance, or you're getting dressed, not just being aware of that action, but aware of the action within the context of Buddha Dhamma, in the context of the Buddha's teaching. You can take impermanence as the framework for your daily practice. Constantly observing, noticing, training the mind to hone in on the changes, the impermanence of each experience. You can take selflessness, anatta, as a practice, the perception of selflessness. You may use a mantra, anatta, 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 just keep that going while you're going about your duties. If you have to talk and participate in meetings and relate to other people, then you adapt the mindfulness practice in a way that you can feel a continuity of mindfulness, even though the object of mindfulness may change. The sitting practice, walking practice, is one of sustaining mindfulness on a particular object. The mindfulness is sustained over a period of some minutes, then a stream of mindfulness occurs. A stream of mindfulness we refer to as samadhi. So samadhi is not something you do. Samadhi is the name for an unbroken, uninterrupted stream of mindfulness. Mindfulness means not forgetting what you're doing, not forgetting your responsibilities, not forgetting everything which pertains to the performance of a particular activity well. So it may, in some cases, require remembering information that one has learnt in the past. In the case of a meditation session, remembering the relevant teachings, remembering the antidotes to the various problems and imbalances that may arise, remembering, of course, the object itself, not forgetting what needs to be remembered is mindfulness. At the same time, one needs the quality of alertness, the awakened quality. And this is the quality that tends to dip and to fade over the course of meditation session. One way of preventing that happening, a very simple method, is just to say, awake, awake, clear, bright. Choose a word that you find inspiring and turns the mind to that quality very naturally. Is there that awakened, bright, clear, alertness of attention? Of the hindrances that we meet in meditation, we notice a spectrum from the very coarse expression of the hindrance to the very subtle and refined. And in the case of the third hindrance, of sloth and torpor, we see that in its very coarse form, it can be expressed as physically nodding backwards and forwards and more or less falling asleep. But that hindrance may also be very subtle, and you may be sitting very straight and sit for a long time and end the meditation and feel quite refreshed, almost as if you'd had a nice little nap. Kind of feels nice. So sloth and torpor can be experienced as a good meditation, kind of peaceful, a fuzzy, cozy kind of mental state. and if you're not very clear in your aspiration for liberation, then that can be very easily become a refuge. Don't think a lot, not worrying, not suffering a lot, and meditating and the mind just slips into that kind of warm, cozy, fuzzy, non-threatening state of mind. But that's a mara, and that's an obstacle. And so this is why we to just check every now and again, is that sense of clarity and alertness and clear comprehension present or not? One way of putting our minds to the test, if you like, we think we're reasonably mindful and awake, then try counting the breaths. If you're kidding yourself and you're in a fuzzy state, even though you feel quite calm, you find that the mind is kind of reluctant and has no flexibility, has no malleability. The mindful state is one in which the mind is firm as a rock, but it can be instantly inclined in any direction that one chooses. So it combines the virtues of firmness and workability. The mind which has been stealthily enveloped by the subtle kind of sloth and torpor is one which feels quite nice, but it's unworkable, it's stubborn, and you give it some work to do and it won't do it very well. So just as a test, now and again, while you're dwelling on the breath, just try counting the breaths for a while and see how easily that is accomplished. If it's found a lot more difficult than you might have thought, then that's an indication that the mind is not as mindful as that one had imagined. The practice is one in which we need to overcome these twin obstacles of craving and ignorance. And the reflective practices, techniques, work directly on avijja or ignorance. But it's the practice of mindfulness, clarifying consciousness, developing the wholesome qualities in the mind, which works directly on craving. And this is why both the ability to still and ground the mind and the ability to look and penetrate the nature of things must work in tandem. The word defilement is one that we use frequently in Dhamma talks and in our general conversation about practice. But it's only when we have a direct experience of the non-defiled mind that we really understand what defilement means. Although we can say that sensual desire, ill will, aversion, sloth and torpor and so on are defilements, we don't experience them as defiling or sullying of the mind until we have an experience of their absence and we have something to contrast and compare them with. This is one of the great values of the stilling, calming practices. So if you've developed that mindfulness until it is clear and bright and the mind is still and is let go of the hindrances, then a great joy and bliss arises in the mind with the recognition of the absence of hindrances. If one has realized that calmness and stillness after the meditation is over, then one can reflect on the beauty, the nobility, the sense of inner clarity that one has experienced, and consider its implications for one's sense of self. It is perhaps reasonably easy to see the ways in which the physical body lacks an owner. You can see the constant changes in the physical body throughout the day and over a period of weeks, months, years. The idea that the physical body is not self, has no owner, is not so difficult to grasp. Much more difficult for us is the idea that we're not our thinking, that thinking has no owner. And we grasp onto thinking as a refuge. And just as, say, the world, the physical world abhors a vacuum, the unenlightened mind fears the lack of thought. Feel if we had no thinking in our mind, we'd cease to exist. You know, we are what we think. But in the in experience of inner stillness and clarity, meditation, then we see, we realize we've experienced a state in which we've never felt so real, never felt so alive, and yet every aspect of the thinking mind and all those personality traits which we formerly identified with so strongly are at that time completely absent. So one way of developing wisdom is this reflection, this looking at arising and passing away. But another dimension of that is looking at experiences in meditation in light of our idea and our understanding of who and what we are. The comprehension, clear penetration of the nature of suffering is only possible in a happy mind. If you're suffering, you can't understand suffering. It's only when you're really happy that you know what suffering is. If you still think, I'm suffering, that's not comprehension of the noble truth of suffering. The ability to sustain mindfulness, to sustain alertness, clarity of mind, to maintain the mind's freedom from hindrances is what provides the mind with the sense of happiness and self-confidence, stability, which gives it the fearlessness necessary to look at the empty nature of the five khandhas. So we're looking, learning, and we begin to see more clearly, don't we, that there's nothing there that we can say, yes, this is who I really am. My favorite simile is of a river. And say we take the River Thames, for instance. The River Thames certainly exists, there's no question about that. But what exactly is it? What do we mean when we talk about the River Thames? Certainly if we say the water, then the obvious answer to that is that the water that you see one day has very soon flowed into the sea. So the water that forms the body of the River Thames is constantly changing. There's no stable body of water. The fish, the creatures within the river, even the stones, the pebbles, everything that goes to make up the River Thames is in constant motion, flux, according to causes and conditions. So to say that there's the River Thames is anatta doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It merely means that we're become more clear in our minds as to the relationship between names, labels, and reality. So we have ourselves, Ajahn Jayasaro, as he exists. I think so, but the thought I exist is rising, passing away. How do we use this word I? Say, I'm tired, I feel energetic, I have a pain in the leg, I feel happy, I remember, I anticipate, I hear, I see. We have this single word I. And yet when we look at what that word refers to, we see a constant flux and nothing stable. Sometimes we use the word I to refer to the physical body, sometimes to feelings, sometimes to memories and perceptions, sometimes to thoughts, opinions, sometimes to sense consciousness. But just as we use this single word, River Thames, to refer to a complex phenomena in the physical world, so we use the word I to refer to a complex phenomena, five khandhas arising, passing away, exist, but not in the way that we usually think they do. We start to look more closely at the physical, the thinking process, the most deliberate kind of thinking process, making a decision. Say we have a difficult decision to make, so we weigh things up in our minds, we look at all the pros and cons, and we spend a long time thinking about it, what's the right thing to do, this way or that way, and then we make a decision based on that. Or so we believe. But have you ever caught that decision-making process? And to see how the final decision happens inside us, just like a sneeze, that the rational process of weighing up the pros and cons is not necessarily that which results in the decision in the way that we might like to think. We certainly would like to consider ourselves rational beings, but does that perception of ourselves bear up to what's really happening? Looking, considering, using the meditation practice to strengthen the mindfulness muscle. If you perform any kind of exercise in a consistent way, the muscles that are used in that exercise become strong. If you meditate regularly, the mind wanders off, you bring it back, the mind wanders off, you bring it back, your mindfulness muscle becomes strong. And you notice in your daily life you don't get caught up with things so easily. If you do, you realize more quickly, you awaken in the present moment more quickly, and you're more capable of bringing the mind back. And that enhanced ability to recognize, to awaken in daily life, enhanced ability to bring the mind back to the present moment, is all the result of this hard work you do on the meditation kundalini. cushion, bringing the mind back over and over again, doing the work of developing the mindfulness muscle. So there is a constant effort to be mindful, adapting the object of mindfulness as is appropriate. If you're in, let's say, a meeting, what are you mindful of? Well, being mindful of your breath is probably not the best option there. You're watching your breath going in and going out. You're not going to contribute to the meeting very successfully. So in that case, you're mindful of speech, mindful of speech within the framework of Samma Vajja, right speech in the Eightfold Path. And you're aware of the feelings and perceptions that arise in the course of a meeting. How does it feel when you say something and everyone agrees? How does it feel when you say something and nobody agrees? How does it feel when someone praises you? How does it feel when someone criticizes you? Is your reaction to praise and blame always the same, or does it depend on who praises you and who blames you? How well do you express yourself when you're energetic? How well do you express yourself when you're tired? What's the effect of the physical body? How long you've been sitting in one place, physical discomfort on your ability to contribute. How much do you fear criticism? How much do you desire praise? How much is the pain of blame conditioned by the intensity of desire for praise? Do you get bored? What's boredom? To what extent is boredom conditioned by a desire for excitement? So many things that we can be mindful of in that kind of situation. So there's a constant challenge and interest in maintaining the mind free of hindrances, maintaining mind with mindfulness, clarity, awareness, effort, seeking to abandon the unwholesome, develop the wholesome, purify the mind. Clearer the mind is, brighter, sharper, the more still, the more grounded the mind is, the more the mind has liberated from like and dislike, the more clearly it will see the nature of phenomena. More clearly sees, the more insight into impermanence, more insight into dukkha, more insight into anatta, the more compassion, kindness that arises. Insight without, which doesn't lead to, is not accompanied by kindness and compassion, is inauthentic. Kindness and compassion, which is not based on a clear understanding of the way things are, is inauthentic. The proof of wisdom is in the compassion. The proof of the compassion is in the wisdom. Looking, learning, gradually moving onwards, the sense of chanta. And the Buddha taught us to be, as monastics, to be content with four requisites. Content with whatever robes, whatever cloth is given to us, whatever food is offered is all right, whatever lodging, whatever room we're given is all right, whatever medical treatment we're offered is all right. As monastics, we are human beings that have no rights at all, We don't have any rights to good robes, no rights to good food, no rights to a nice place to live, no rights to medical treatment when we get sick. We don't have any rights at all. Everything that comes through the faith and the goodwill of our lay supporters. The moment we think we have a right to delicious food, or we have a right to a particular level of comfort, then we're not leading the samana life anymore. We should always be ready to take the worst, the coarsest, the least at any time and whenever, and it's usually the case that we receive the best, then we never take that for granted. The essence of a monastic lifestyle, the consciousness of the samana, is never to take anything at all for granted. Even the next in-breath, we don't take for granted, let alone for requisites or support from our lay supporters. But although contentment is primary virtue and a primary engine of the higher levels of spiritual practice, the Buddha also taught us to be discontent with the wholesome qualities that we have attained. Indeed, the Buddha identified his own discontent with the spiritual attainments he had already developed before his enlightenment as one of the two primary causes for conditions for his enlightenment. So we are content with our physical situation and requisites, and discontent with whatever we have realized and attained in our practice. We've seen over the course of years now many monks who have been in the robe, nun and nuns who've been in the robes for 10, 20 years, and they've still disrobed and gone back to the lay community. Why should that be so? Because, a complex of reasons, and each person different. I would say that one thing they would lack is that discontent in wholesome states that have been developed. Buddha laid down the vinaya to create the conditions, external conditions, most conducive for realization of Nibbana. And if we practice for a number of years, mind becomes calmer, the coarser defilements somewhat attenuated, certainly the mind not so agitated and coarse as it was before we began practice. But we can compare our minds to a glass of water full of nasty germs, and the only way to get rid of those germs is to boil the water at 100 degrees centigrade. Now if you heat that water to 95 degrees centigrade, it can seem extremely hot and very close to boiling. But if you don't take it all the way to 100 degrees, then whenever the heat under the glass, or the temperature of the water cools, then all the germs can multiply once more. It's only when they reach the level of boiling 100 degrees that those germs completely disappear. So even if you've taken your practice to a steady 95 degrees centigrade level, all the germs are all still there. There's nothing stable, there's no stable attainments until stream entry. It's only the stream entry that one is safe. If you're still not reached the level of stream entry, then you're still in the war zone. You know, if you're countries at war, you can find little pockets of peace, little villages as yet unbombed, unaffected by the war. But those villages are still in the war zone and they can be bombed at any time. They're not safe, they're not secure. Similarly, the good qualities that we have attained are not fixed. They're not anything that can be truly relied upon as refuges until we take the mind beyond the first three of the fetters. As long as there is sakkaya ditti, there is a superstitious belief in the body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, consciousness as constituting a real self, then we're still on very shaky ground. And wrong views and delusions can still appear. All kinds of nasty germs can assert themselves if we're heedless. So the Buddha says, be content with the robes, the food, the living place, the medicines, no rights, no demands, no expectations, but at the same time, completely discontent with the attainments that one has already realized and striving onwards, moving onwards. This is the image. The Dhamma leads us onwards, leads us inwards, because onwards and inwards means the same thing. So I'd like to offer this reflection to you all this evening.